cfrc.ca.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The strikes happened at night. We went out after hearing the sounds and we saw a fire there. Then we realized that Israel struck these locations. We didn't get a break from Turkey, and now Israel came. Israel has been striking the area for a while now.
After the historic collapse of Syria's Assad regime, Israeli forces bomb Syria hundreds of times as different Syrian factions vie for power. Meanwhile, Syrians are celebrating the regime's fall while grappling with the enormity of what happens next. We'll speak with Syrian-American political economist Omar Dahi. Then, as thousands of Syrians are released from prison, we'll look at a new report on Palestinian prisoners in the occupied West Bank from the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. It's called Unleashed, Abuse of Palestinians by Israeli Soldiers in the Center of Hebron.
We interviewed about 20 witnesses. We took more than 20 testimonies concerning incidents that took place in Hebron in the summer of 2024. And those testimonies indicate that extreme violence amounting to abuse has become routine among Israeli soldiers in the West Bank.
And New York prosecutors have arrested 26-year-old Luigi Mangione and charged him with murder for the killing of United Health executive Brian Thompson. As many offer condolences to Thompson's loved ones, his killing has sparked outrage over the state of health care in the United States.
United Healthcare denials of coverage. Interesting that one of the shell casings had the word deny written on it. And it made me think of the time they tried to deny coverage for my mother's dialysis.
We'll speak with the People's Action Institute and with former health insurance executive Wendell Potter, author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's military has launched a wide-scale assault on Syria after the fall of Bashar al-Assad's regime, bombing military sites, weapons warehouses, airports, army air bases, and cities and provinces across Syria, including the capital, Damascus. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports in just the 2 days, Israel's carried out some 340 airstrikes. Meanwhile, the governments of Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar have condemned Israel's seizure of more land in the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights, saying it violates a 1974 ceasefire. Israel seized the Golan Heights in 1967 and later annexed the region. On Monday, the armed groups who toppled Syria's longtime authoritarian President Bashar al-Assad said a Syrian transitional authority would be headed by Prime Minister Mohammed al-Bashir, an engineer who served as the fifth prime minister of the self-declared Syrian Salvation Government. We'll have more on Syria after headlines. The government of Austria says it'll begin deporting Syrian refugees following the revolution that toppled Bashar al-Assad's regime. About 100,000 Syrians have resettled in Austria in the 13 years since Syria's civil war erupted. Meanwhile, the governments of Belgium, France, Greece, Germany, and the United Kingdom said they would pause applications for asylum by Syrians. More than 14 million people have fled Syria since 2011. The largest share of refugees, about 3 million, live in Turkey. On Monday, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan ordered the reopening of two border crossings in southern Turkey, where hundreds of refugees queued up to return to Syria. In news from Gaza, multiple massacres carried out by Israeli forces across the war-torn Palestinian territory killed dozens of people since Monday, many of them children. These included an Israeli air attack on a flour distribution line in southern Rafah and strikes on central Gaza's Nusayrat camp. In northern Beit Hanun, separate Israeli strikes killed 25 people belonging to two households of the Al-Khalut family, wiping the prominent Gaza family entirely from the civil registry. Israel's also continuing its deadly assault on Gaza's beleaguered hospitals. Dr. Marwan Al-Sultan, director of Indonesian Hospital in northern Gaza, called on international actors to help ensure the safety of health facilities after Israeli attacks injured patients and destroyed parts of the hospital. In the occupied West Bank, at least two Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on the city of Tubas on Monday. The victims were 26 and 32 years old. The attack came about a week after Palestinian authorities reported Israeli soldiers besieged the Tubas hospital, assaulting and arresting medical staff and patients. Meanwhile, the Israeli army detained at least 16 Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank Monday. Israeli forces have arrested over 12,000 Palestinians in the West Bank since last October. This all comes as the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has released a new report detailing the gruesome abuse by Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in the city of Hebron. B'Tselem documented the testimony of over 20 Palestinians, one as young as 14, who describe being beaten, sexually assaulted, and in one case even being stabbed by Israeli soldiers. We'll have more on this report later in the broadcast. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu returned to a courtroom in Jerusalem today to face multiple charges of corruption, fraud, breach of the public trust, and bribery. All three trials have been postponed on multiple occasions, first due to the COVID-19 pandemic and later as Netanyahu led Israel's devastating assault on Gaza. In one case, Netanyahu is accused of enacting regulatory decisions worth hundreds of millions of dollars to the owner of an online news site in exchange for a promise to drop negative stories about Netanyahu. In another case, Netanyahu is accused of accepting champagne, cigars, and other gifts from two wealthy businessmen in exchange for political favors. Ukraine says Russian artillery fire killed a 91-year-old woman in the village in the eastern Donetsk region on Monday in an attack that wounded four others. Separately, one man was reportedly killed and seven others wounded in Russian attacks on the southern Kherson region. Russia's latest attacks came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky proposed a settlement to end Russia's assault, calling for the deployment of foreign troops in Ukraine while Kyiv waits for its application to join NATO. Zelensky made the proposal after meeting with Friedrich Merz, the conservative candidate for Chancellor of Germany, who made a surprise trip to Kyiv on Monday. After talks with Zelensky, Merz said that if elected to lead Germany, he would seek to send long-range cruise missiles to Ukraine.
Auch die meiner Bundestagsfraktion. Wir wollen ihre Armee.
We want your army to be capable of hitting military bases in Russia, not the civilian population, not infrastructure, but the military targets from which your country is being attacked. And I said it a few weeks ago in the German parliament. With these range limits, we are forcing your country to fight with one hand tied behind your back. This is not our position.
Here in the United States, authorities in Pennsylvania have arrested and charged a 26-year-old white man with murder over the fatal shooting of the United Healthcare CEO in Manhattan last week. Luigi Mangione was apprehended at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Monday after an employee called in a tip. Police found what they believe is a ghost gun and silencer, likely made with a 3D printer. Ghost guns are self-assembled with kits purchased online and do not carry serial numbers. Authorities also found a handwritten manifesto which reads, quote, "These parasites had it coming. I do apologize for any strife and trauma, but it had to be done," unquote. The manifesto also states he was working alone and condemned corporations that, quote, "continue to abuse our country for immense profit because the American public has allowed them to get away with it," unquote. Mangione is from a prominent Baltimore family, but appears to have withdrawn from his friends and family around 6 months ago. He suffered from a severe, debilitating back injury and has undergone surgery for his condition. He went to the Gilman School in Baltimore, an elite private school, and then to the University of Pennsylvania for undergrad and a graduate degree in engineering. Meanwhile, in New York, advocates have highlighted the stark contrast in the response to the shooting of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson and another fatal attack that took place one day later on a Manhattan street. 17-year-old Jeremy Colino, who was living at an immigrant shelter, was stabbed to death. Another teenager was also stabbed but survived. A group of assailants who are still on the loose asked the two teens if they spoke English right before the deadly attack. A New York jury on Monday acquitted subway vigilante Daniel Penny in the chokehold death of street performer Jordan Neely on a Manhattan subway train last May, finding Penny not guilty of criminally negligent homicide. 30-year-old Neely, a beloved Michael Jackson impersonator, was unhoused and hungry, crying out for help on the subway when Penny, a white former U.S. Marine, attacked him, pinned him down on a subway train by the neck for 6 minutes. Neely's family separately filed a civil lawsuit against Penny. Neely's father, Andre Zachary, was removed from the New York courtroom yesterday after protesting the not guilty verdict, along with others. Zachary spoke from outside the courthouse.
I miss my son. My son didn't have to go through this. I didn't have to go through this either. It hurts. Really, really hurts. What are we going to do, people? What's going to happen to us now? Enough of this. The system is rigged.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, people. Let's do something about this.
And Nikki Giovanni, one of the most celebrated poets in the United States, has died of cancer at the age of 81. Giovanni was dubbed the Princess of Black Poetry after she published her first collection of poems, Black Feeling, Black Talk, in 1968. She went on to publish more than 30 books, including a memoir that was a finalist for the National Book Award and a children's picture book titled Rosa about the civil rights legend Rosa Parks. Nikki Giovanni was a distinguished professor of English at Virginia Tech University, where in the fall of 2005, she removed a student from her introductory creative writing course and reported his disturbing behavior to her department head. That student would go on to kill 32 people and wound 17 others in a campus shooting at Virginia Tech, after which Giovanni became a fierce advocate for gun control. Democracy Now! Went to Virginia Tech to interview Nikki Giovanni, and then in 2013, Giovanni joined us in our Democracy Now! Studio here in New York, where she shared some of her poems.
Poetry is as necessary to life as salt is to stew, as garlic is to pasta, as perfume is to summer nights, as shaving lotion is to mornings, as your smile is to my happiness. Poetry is as significant to life as yeast is to bread, as butter is to toast, as grapes are to wine, as sugar is to lemons. How else will we get lemonade? Poetry is to me your voice, your touch, your laughter, that feeling at the end of the day that I am not alone.
Nikki Giovanni has died at the age of 81 of cancer. To see our interviews with her, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with Syria and the aftermath of the historic collapse of the Assad regime. Israeli forces are continuing to attack key military sites, airports, and army air bases in cities across Syria, including the capital, Damascus. In just the last 48 hours, Israel's carried out 340 airstrikes, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. A resident from Qamishli in northeastern Syria described the strikes that took place Monday night.
The strikes happened at night. We went out after hearing the sounds and we saw a fire there. Then we realized that Israel struck these locations. We didn't get a break from Turkey, and now Israel came. Israel has been striking the area for a while now.
Turkey and the United States have also continued to strike targets in Syria since the lightning offensive led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. In a message posted to Telegram Tuesday, the rebel commander, Ahmed Shara, vowed to hold senior officials in the Assad regime accountable for, quote, torturing the Syrian people, unquote. As different factions of armed groups vie for power and their international backers defend their interests, Syrians are grappling with the enormity of what has happened to their country and what comes next. In 13 years of war, over 350,000 people have been killed, according to the United Nations, over 14 million displaced. President Bashar al-Assad has now fled to Russia, where he's been granted political asylum with his family. Syrians are adjusting to the new reality of life after 50 years of rule by the Assad family, Hafez al-Hafez and his son, Bashar.
Today, we don't give our joy to anyone. We have been waiting for this day for 50 years. All the people were silenced and could not speak out because of this tyranny. Today, we thank and ask God to reward everyone who contributed to this day, the day of liberation. We were living in a big prison that was Syria. It's been 50 years during which we couldn't speak, nor express ourselves, nor express our worries. Anyone who spoke out was detained in prisons, as you saw in Sidonia.
For more on the dramatic changes in Syria, we're joined by Omar Dahi, Syrian-American economics professor at Hampshire College, director of the Security and Context Research Network, where he focuses on political economy in Syria and the social and economic consequences of the war. He was born and raised in Syria and involved in several peace-building initiatives since the conflict began. Professor Omar Dahi joins us now from Amherst, Massachusetts. Professor, welcome to Democracy Now! First, your response to Assad's departure, him fleeing with his family to Russia, and what this means for Syria.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me. I've been watching, like many others from outside the country, in shock and disbelief in this past 2 weeks. And with mixed emotions in many ways. First, shock and disbelief at the collapse of the Syrian regime and the way it happened after 13 or more years of conflict, where there were front lines that were frozen for the past several years, but suddenly they disappeared. Of course, incredible joy at the personal level and also for millions of Syrians who were directly hurt by the regime, both through the violence of the war, the displacement, the killings and tortures that were taking place, as well as previously before the war. It's been incredible watching the scenes of the liberation of prisoners from prisons like Sednaya, which have been referred to, I think, correctly as human slaughterhouses. It's been incredibly moving to see people celebrating in the streets, people saying that they can finally go home, they can finally speak their mind. So all that has been really a joy to watch and witness as we kind of see the sequence of events unfold with the, you know, Bashar al-Assad fleeing to Russia. Thankfully, this process, which we can talk more about, happened finally with as minimal bloodshed as possible, even though there was plenty of bloodshed over the past years. But in the way it had happened, it actually provided a possibility for positive change, at least at the moment. But this joy is also tempered with lots of other feelings as well, primarily the costs at which this happened. And I would say the costs are the human costs that you outlined, which may be even more in terms of the people killed. Entire generations had been destroyed. There is a generation of Syrians that grew up in displacement in refugee camps. The destruction that happened to the country, all the human cost and the physical cost, I think it's hard to say that it was not too high. It's impossible to say that it was okay that all this happened. There are other costs, of course. The other cost is the loss of sovereignty of Syria, which has been a process ongoing for 10 years. Syria was occupied and invaded by the United States, by Turkey, on the opposition side and on the Syrian government side. It drew on its allies to defend itself, Russia and Iran, which came to place the regime in a position of dependency. So there were multiple foreign types of occupations in the country, which we see what is happening now in the Israeli airstrikes as a continuation of that loss of sovereignty. And I think this is something that Syrians have to grapple with. There are other costs of the war as well. There are the empowerment of actors that are not acceptable to a wide variety of Syrian society. Not that there isn't some backing for them, particularly because they have a certain legitimacy for many Syrians because they fought the government, but the current government in power or the current, you know, HTS is not acceptable to large parts of Syrian society. And there's already warnings that it's acting as a de facto power and people are warning against that. And of course, there's the final thing, which is that this is tempered by the regional context, which is the ongoing Israeli genocide in Palestine that is empowered by the U.S. And we've seen over the past couple of days a complete destruction of what was remaining of Syrian army military assets by Israel with complete impunity. So all of those, we're trying to take all those contradictions together. Joy for the people, joy for the moment that many millions had dreamed of, which is the departure of the Assad family from power, and the feeling that politics is finally possible in Syria. Despite all these contradictions, there is a chance for political life to resume. There's a chance for advocacy for a collectively better future. And this is something that we all have to try and, you know, hold and support.
Professor, I'm wondering if you could talk briefly about your own family's history. In the 1990s, your father helped smuggle out names of political prisoners, many of them accused of belonging to the League of Communist Labor. Yet the Ba'athist Party and the government of your country often talked about being a socialist.
Yeah, this was a kind of a spur of the moment post that I did on social media to share these documents that I received after my father passed away 3 or 4 years ago. Basically, my father was a lawyer and was among of two or three or maybe four lawyers who stepped up in the 1990s. To defend a large group of political prisoners, many of them communists, many of them who were accused of being members of the Muslim Brotherhood. They were basically detained without a trial, or not even just a trial, but without a formal charge. They were accused of belonging to this outlawed Party of Communist Labor, which was accused by the government of mounting an insurrection against it in the late 70s and 80s. So most of those who were detained in the 1980s. They had been disappeared. Their families didn't know anything about them. Most people didn't know, like many of the people we're discovering in Saydnaya prison today, were not aware whether they were dead or alive or their whereabouts. So my father would basically meet with some of those prisoners when allowed to do so. And really, it was the courage of the prisoners to assemble a lot of this data, to write down their names, their dates of birth, their professions, where they were, when they were arrested, what's their charge, where they were being held, mostly in this case in Saydnaya prison. And also, you know, if they were in, you know, they needed medical attention, they were, you know, traumatized or they were injured in some way. And I had asked my dad why he did this, actually, because, you know, there was no sense that these prisoners would be freed. So they, most of them ended up being put on trial en masse and convicted. So he told me that he had no expectation of justice at that time, but that he felt it was necessary to do it, to use any opening and any chance to expose the hypocrisy of the government for the same reasons that you mentioned, that he didn't expect them to actually be, you know, receive a fair trial, which they didn't. But there has to be a chance to basically, you know, put the government's declared principles against its actions and expose the government. So this was a historical document that I was kind of moved to share when the images of the prisoners were being released from Saydnaya. Most of those names in those documents have either unfortunately passed away or were released from the prison. So I didn't expect that there'd be actually some of those people actually there. But yeah, that's why I shared that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned the foreign presence in Syria. Hasn't the country effectively during this this civil war been already partitioned with Turkish troops creating a buffer zone in the north, the Israelis not only recently in the past few days entering Syrian territory, but conducting military operations in the territory previous to that with the Kurds backed by the U.S., ISIS still controlling portions of territory and the Russian bases in the country? How do you have any sense of the integrity of the country being reconstituted anytime soon?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be a long-term struggle, and partly because of the reasons you mentioned, because this is something that has been happening for a decade, and there are kind of entrenched interests that have developed, not just in terms of a foreign occupation, but in terms of the connection of various parts of Syrian society and their ties to those countries in ways that they've come to basically be affiliated or allied with them. And this is reminiscent for people who observe Syria of the post-independence period in Syrian history when Syria was a site of struggle by external powers because it was weak, it was politically divided, and various regional powers basically came to have significant influence in the country through Syrian political elites. This was transformed by the Assad family and the Ba'ath Party in ways that actually flipped this around, where Syria consolidated its power and projected its power, at least regionally. But it came at a price, I think, that was high and unsustainable, particularly for Syrian society. Now this has actually completely been shattered. And I think there's going to be an attempt to rewrite the history of the Syrian conflict in ways that pin the blame completely on the Assad regime, which I don't think is the case. I think they are primarily at fault for this, not just because of their governance, which was brutal and tyrannical and maintained an exclusive monopoly on power for decades without recognizing any dissent, without recognizing any political opposition. Not just because of the reaction to the uprising when it first started, where they completely closed down any meaningful political transition, but also because even after they won the war, they spent many years refusing any political initiative to reconcile after they had, with the help of Russia and Iran, win the war, basically. So the front lines had been frozen for many years. But all the other international actors also contributed to the destruction of the country, I think. There were ways in which, this fragmentation didn't just imply an obvious loss of sovereignty in the abstract sense, but also destroyed the economy. It fragmented the Syrian national economy. It created kind of perverse war economies in the country. And as you said, Israel has been bombing Syria for the past decade. This bombing escalates after the collapse of the government. They further invaded Syrian territory, and we saw the incursions and the devastation that took place in the last couple of days.
If you can talk about who Mohammed al-Bashir is, the man who's been appointed the temporary prime minister right now of Syria, and also HTS, its role, listed as a terrorist movement by the U.S., the EU, the U.K., and Turkey. The U.N. Special Envoy for Syria told the Financial Times that international powers seeking a peaceful transition in the country would have to consider lifting this designation. Who Abu Mohammed al-Jalani, now his birth name is Ahmed Sharah, is?
Yes, well, I'm not an expert on Ahmed Sharah's personal history. Some of that has come out in recent days about his birth in Syria. He claims he was radicalized by the Palestinian Intifada, and he joined Al-Qaeda in Syria and Iraq. And Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is basically a splinter group from Al-Qaeda that had basically come, it was based in Iraq and then came back to Syria after the uprising started. And there was a period of time, which maybe your audience will remember, when Syria fragmented into various militias. And there was just as much infighting among those militias, among themselves, between the opposition groups, just as much as they were fighting the Syrian government. So basically, their groups similar to Hayat Tahrir al-Sham were fighting each other. And then there was a period of reconsolidation, particularly in the aftermath of the attack on ISIS and the kind of permanent or the, you know, more or less consolidation of Syria into various spheres of influence with U.S. presence and Kurdish-led political and military groups in the northeast, Turkish control in the northwest. And under the areas that were generally under Turkish influence, there were areas that were directly tied to Turkey and areas in which Turkey had influence. And this is the area that came to be consolidated by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. So they have a bloody history, not just prior to the war, but actually during the war, with respect to even other opposition groups and kind of basically, you know, during the time of their rule in the province of Idlib. Right now, and during this past 2 weeks, there's been a lot of positive signs in terms of the way they approached the collapse of the Syrian regime. The signs that were verbal, the signs that were actually in actions in terms of trying to protect all government institutions, all public institutions, despite the fact that there have been incidents of looting and sabotage in various ways. But at least they've been trying to speak at a national of a national interest in some ways. That's, of course, has to be put to the test. There's already critiques of their rule because they unilaterally imposed a transitional government on Syria, which most Syrians would reject as something that they don't have the authority to do. It's also happening at in a context where, of course, Syria is still under economic sanctions. So you've had devastation from many years of the war, and you've had also devastation of Syrian society because of the crippling economic sanctions. Primarily imposed by the U.S. and the European Union.
We just have 30 seconds.
So all of that is really going to be basically coming into play over the coming days, basically, and months. And we'll see how, you know, the regional context basically influences what's happening domestically.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Of course, we're going to continue to follow what happens with Syria. Omar Dahi, Syrian-American economics professor at Hampshire College and director of the Security and Context Research Network. Coming up, we go to the West Bank to a new report by B'Tselem. As thousands of Syrians are being released from Syrian prisons, we'll look at a new report on Palestinian prisoners in Hebron in the occupied West Bank. It's called Unleashed, Abuse of Palestinians by Israeli Soldiers in the Center of Hebron. Back in 20 seconds.
ولا ولد السلطان حاجيتك ما جيتك ودينا بعيد مدى الدنيا حاجيتك
راوي, the storyteller by Sawad Massi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As Israeli raids continue across the occupied West Bank, we turn to a new report from the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem that details the gruesome abuse of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in Hebron. B'Tselem documented the testimonies of over 20 Palestinians between May and August. They describe being punched, kicked, sexually abused, beaten with rifles, clubs, or chairs, being whipped with a belt, having foul-smelling liquid poured on them. In one case, even being stabbed by Israeli soldiers. One of the Palestinian teens B'Tselem spoke to is Mahmoud Ghanem, an 18-year-old engineering student attacked by five Israeli soldiers at a checkpoint in July. A warning to our audience, these testimonies are graphic.
They dragged us to the jeep and made us kneel. I was still tied up. Then he blindfolded me, grabbed me by the hair, and banged my head against the jeep door three times, each harder than before. He hit me violently on my chest and stepped hard on my legs. Then he started punching me in the stomach. One of them grabbed me by the neck and pulled me up until I couldn't breathe. The other punched me hard in the stomach. Then, while I was trying to catch my breath, he stepped on my testicles.
And this is the testimony of 52-year-old Yasser Abu Makie, who lives across from the Gilbert checkpoint in Hebron and is the director of the Ibrahim al-Khalil Association in Tel Rameda, which is involved in cultural and educational projects in the occupied West Bank. He was questioned, detained, and beaten by Israeli soldiers in July.
They treated me barbarically and arrested me for no reason. I was in pain and suffered beating, humiliation, and mental torture. I was very confused and scared. When I got to the Gilbert checkpoint by my house, an Israeli soldier demanded my ID card and I handed it over. He demanded the phone too and I handed it over. Then he said, "You're making a lot of trouble. You gave an interview on Al Jazeera." And I said, "That's right, I did." He tied my hands and ordered me to sit on the ground. The four soldiers from the military post arrived. They blindfolded me, and before they took me away, they hit me on the head and kicked me.
Those are some of the disturbing testimonies included in B'Tselem's new report titled Unleashed, Abuse by Palestinians by Israeli Soldiers in the Center of Hebron. Since launching its war on Gaza last October, Israel's intensified attacks across the occupied West Bank, carrying out near daily raids that have led to the arrest of some 12,000 Palestinians. For more, we go to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Sarit Michaeli, the International Outreach Director for the Israeli Human Rights Group B'Tselem. Sarit, welcome back to Democracy Now! We are seeing images of thousands fleeing Syrian prisons and hearing the stories of hell inside. You, at the same time, have come out with this report on what's happening to Palestinian prisoners in Hebron. Describe what shocked you most in what you are learning.
I mean, thank you very much, Amy and Juan. It's good to be with you. And I think the most fundamental issue is that Israel claims to be a different society to Syria, right? Israel claims to be a democracy. We would argue that this is not the case. But in terms of the standards we have to set, these are just absolutely different standards to what we would expect. In terms of what we discovered in this report, I think on some levels, in a sense, the obvious. We've seen the increase, the massive increase in the violence that Israel has inflicted on Palestinians since Hamas's criminal actions, criminal attack on October 7th, in the, you know, the slaughter in Gaza, and also in the dehumanization discourse inside Israel. And therefore, on many levels, it's not surprising that Israeli soldiers who listen to Israeli leaders will act in a way that reflects this dehumanization. But there is also something extremely shocking about this, because the violence that we documented, it was new, not because there hasn't been violence by soldiers against Palestinians in the West Bank and in the city of Hebron before, but the scope of it, the scale of it, the fact that it was done in broad daylight, the fact that it was almost random in terms of the choice of victim. It wasn't people being beaten up for something they allegedly did, like throwing stones or being rude. It was Palestinians being beaten up and facing severe abuse merely for being Palestinians. In some way, it's as if the soldiers were just revenging Hamas's attack and kind of imposing this vengeance on all Palestinians. They were selected almost at random, and this was done broadly. It's very clear that everyone was aware that this was being done.
And Sadiq, very few, according to your report, of the people who were initially detained or even charged with any offense?
I think this is exactly the point. It's not as if Palestinians arrested someone, had an actual realistic allegation against them, whether that's true or not, and then proceeded to beat them up. Soldiers approached Palestinians who were going about their daily business. In some cases, they looked for some sort of so-called, quote-unquote, excuse to beat them up, right? So if they had some sort of photo in their phone that the soldiers could interpret as being problematic from their perspective, or in other cases, just the mere fact of walking down the street while Palestinian was enough to trigger this abuse. That's why we talk about it as being quite arbitrary. The victims were selected just by, for just going about their daily business. Additionally, I think one of the other really relatively new things, or the new developments about what we see on the ground, is that there were many threats of sexual violence. This is something I think we should be aware of. We should be mindful of over the past year. Types of sexual violence and threats in our context. Additionally, I think several of the witnesses reported that the soldiers were documenting these incidents, presumably to broadcast them then on social media, and in one case to send to a fiancé, to friends. So none of this is being done in a secretive way. It's all being done in broad daylight.
And also, is Hebron unique in this situation, or is it emblematic of what is going on across the West Bank?
So Hebron is unique in the sense that it is the only Palestinian town or city in the West Bank where there is a constant military presence right in the city center because of the Israeli settlements that are based in the center of Hebron. So because of that, there is always a constant contact. There's an interface between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians in their daily lives. So in that sense, Hebron is unique. But we surmise, we think, and we've reached the conclusion that this level of violence would reflect not just the conduct of soldiers, of Israeli soldiers and other members of the Israeli forces in Hebron city center, but that they are a much broader phenomenon. And we, as an Israeli organization that includes both Israelis and Palestinians, we look also at Israeli society and at what this indicates about the current moment in our society. And I think this is a really important point. The fact that these soldiers know what the spirit of the commander is. They're not doing something of their own private initiative. They're performing abuse that has been incited by Israeli leaders, by politicians, by Israeli media extensively over the past year.
Finally, Sarit Mikhaeli, so you have close to 800 Palestinians dead on the West Bank since October 7th, killed by Israeli soldiers. You have, and settlers, you have 12,000 imprisoned. What are you calling for? What is B'Tselem calling for?
Well, we have discussed in detail what we call the silent war that Israel is conducting in the West Bank. On some levels, it's not totally silent, but this is what one of our witnesses really referred to it. I think one of the main issues that B'Tselem has been addressing over this past year is the connection between our war against the entire Palestinian people, primarily my government essentially has been doing in Gaza, the mass killing of civilians, the utter destruction of Gaza, the devastating humanitarian disaster that our government has caused, together and the connection between this and violence and abuse by soldiers and the use of lethal force, extreme and disproportionate use of lethal force in the West Bank. These are all connected issues, and they can only be addressed with some level of accountability, not just for the crimes being perpetrated in the Gaza Strip, but also for these crimes, for these abuses. We know accountability isn't going to come from within. The Israeli system is unwilling and unable to hold Israeli soldiers and Israeli forces accountable. On the contrary, what they are doing is the result of official incitement, and therefore there has to be international accountability for this. And as we have always stated, the international community has to also act to hold Israeli policymakers accountable for these violations.
Sarit Mikhaeli, we want to thank you for being with us with the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem. The new report will link to Unleashed, Abuse by Palestinians of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers in the center of Hebron. Next up, Luigi Mangione has been arrested and charged with the murder of UnitedHealth executive Brian Thompson. As many offered condolences to Thompson's loved ones, we'll look at how his killing has sparked outrage over the state of health care in the United States. Back in 20 seconds.
Open up your eyes, it's a brand new nation. The people got a prize and a blood celebration. You always used to say that life is not a paid vacation, and living is a curse if you ain't got the purse to pay them. And we can all be free so long as we ain't all too patient. Be a thorn upon the roads, deny, defend, oppose. Yeah, he turned like a worm, but he looked to the graveyard. But guns got a way of hitting hearts, no matter how hard.
Deny, defend, oppose, a song by the folk musician Joe DeVito. The song he shared a few days ago in response to the news of the killing of the UnitedHealthcare CEO. DeVito said, I wanted to throw my two cents in and try and convey that rage and why people are so angry. While people express horror over the murder of the executive, people are also expressing outrage. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. New York prosecutors have charged a suspect with murder for the killing of UnitedHealth executive Brian Thompson. Police arrested 26-year-old Luigi Mangione in Altoona, Pennsylvania, Monday, when a McDonald's customer told an employee that she spotted him after that five-day nationwide search. The employee called the police, who came. They found Mangione with a black ghost gun, which can be assembled from parts and is untraceable. That's similar to one used in the killing of Thompson. While many offered condolences to Thompson's loved ones, his killing sparked outrage over the state of health care in America. Some turned to social media to share their experiences with health insurance companies.
UnitedHealthcare denials of coverage. Interesting that one of the shell casings had the word deny written on it. And it made me think of the time they tried to deny coverage for my mother's dialysis. Yes, you heard that correctly. UnitedHealthcare tried to deny coverage for dialysis.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Washington, D.C., Derek Crowe is with the nonprofit People's Action Institute, which has a care over cost campaign focused on the health insurance company's, quote, systemic practice of refusing to approve care through prior authorization denials or pay for care through claim denials. And in Philadelphia, we're joined by Wendell Potter, former executive for the health insurance companies Cigna and Humana. He's the executive editor of Healthcare Uncovered. Wendell is the author of Deadly Ben, an insurance company insider, speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. And also the book, Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Wendell, let's begin with you. When you heard that the CEO of United Health was murdered on the streets of New York, that the assassin had written the words deny, depose, defend on the bullets, there was this outpouring of anger about healthcare companies, while at the same time, many, of course, expressed condolences to the family of Brian Thompson. Your thoughts?
It was chilling, but not shocking to me. I used to plan the kind of events that Brian Thompson was in New York for, the company's Investor Day. And I want to stress that because it's significant that that's why he was in New York, to attend probably the most important meeting in the company's year, which is meeting with its top institutional investors and Wall Street financial analysts who write reports that help determine the fate of these companies on Wall Street. That's what these companies, that's where they worship. They worship at the altar of Wall Street. I think what we're seeing here is this young man, if this is the suspect who's been arrested, is the assailant, experienced some kind of delay, apparently, or some kind of interaction that did not go well with his insurance company and with the industry. This has been going on for a long time. This company in particular has a record of using prior authorization or refusing to pay for needed care far more than its competitors. But for-profit insurers in general have used this as a means of enriching their shareholders, of using fewer and fewer of our premium dollars to pay for the care that we need so that more money can be made available to their shareholders.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Wendell Potter, there are about an average of 75 homicides per day in the United States. And I was stunned by the level of media attention and law enforcement resources utilized to track down this one killer of a wealthy businessman and health executive. I'm wondering your sense of where our system places its resources.
You know, it's a very good point. so many resources were put on this, obviously, for one reason, because it became such a big media story, and the drama around this made it certainly a compelling story. But we're talking about a person of privilege and great wealth who was killed, and that triggered this this manhunt that I think we, as you said, there are homicides every day in this country, sadly, but you don't have this kind of reaction. But I think part of what's going on here, back to the rage that we've seen on social media, it's just been just barely below the surface, and this triggered something. I'm equating this to kind of a dike bursting. I saw this rage, this outrage, if you will, toward this industry when I worked for it, and it was one of the reasons why I left. I couldn't in good conscience continue to support an industry that used prior authorization, that established themselves firmly between a patient and his or her doctor. That's what these companies have done. And I think that what we're seeing, sadly, in some form or fashion, probably was inevitable because more and more people are facing these denials of care or denials of claims. So people are winding up deep in debt. 100 million Americans have medical debt, but most of those people have health insurance, but they can't get their insurance companies to cover the care that they need. They have to spend so much money out of their own pockets before their coverage will even kick in. So it is a crisis that was brewing, and I think has erupted. And I think the challenge is going to be, what do we make of this? How do we harness this rage? When I say we, I'm talking about advocates and those who know that this system needs a fundamental overhaul like we've never seen before. How do we harness this and channel it in constructive ways to push reforms forward?
I wanted to go back to the healthcare point, but I also wanted to amplify the issue that Juan just raised. New York City Mayor Eric Adams was speaking during the news conference Monday about the arrest of Mangione when he was asked about another case here in New York.
I wanted to ask you about the killing of a migrant teenager last week in the financial district. A group of men attacked him and another migrant after reportedly asking him whether he spoke English or not. What updates do you have in that case? And do you have images of the suspects in that case? And if so, why haven't those been publicized as we saw in this other case? And has the same amount of police resources been spent on his death as the CEO's death?
First and foremost, the fact pattern that you just described about asking, did he speak English, that was not in any of the reports. Any loss is a huge loss.
That is Mayor Adams, and they were talking about the killing of the migrant just a day after Jeremy Colina, who is 17 years old. A group came upon him, and a friend said, "Do you speak English?" When they said no, he was killed. The other was critically wounded. And this question of whether they handed it, got video and photos of the gang that moved on. But we're going to stick right now on the health care issue. Derek Crow is with us of People's Action Institute. Derek, you've been collecting testimony. Your group was involved with a mass arrest. I want to turn to the Color Lines video report that features 29-year-old Carly Morton of Beaver, Pennsylvania, who was supported by People's Action's Care Over Cost campaign.
I have been fighting my medical issues in my insurance company off and on for more than a year. I cried and screamed and requested supervisors. They made it impossible. I thought that that was the end of the road. I'm not getting the surgery, so there's not much of a chance for me. We reached out to People's Action, and they gathered together around me and helped me fight my insurance company. And then when that change happened, it was like all this hope just went inside of me.
Derek Crow of People's Action Institute, you've been putting out videos like these. A whole group of people affiliated with People's Action Institute were just recently arrested outside the offices of the Minneapolis headquarters of United Health. Explain.
Right. Well, first, let me say that we also offer our condolences to the family and friends of Brian Thompson. We obviously condemn any act of gun violence, no matter the motivation. We were shocked by that crime. We were not shocked by the outpouring of rage you mentioned. And I just want to say the thing that took us to that location and that led us to that action were stories just like Carly's. These corporations have too much power in this country. They are blocking progress on issues like gun violence and on the epidemic of care denials in this country, either through prior authorizations or through claims denials. Just like Carly, 248 million care denials are issued by these companies every year, either through a prior authorization denial or a care denial. And people's anxiety and stress and anger about that has just built up to a boiling point. Carly's case, she finally got paid her claim for that surgery only because she worked with us and gathered around with other people who organized in a strategic, nonviolent way to put pressure on these companies. Her condition is terribly painful. It's called NMALS. It's pain when she eats is equivalent, her doctors say, to end-stage pancreatic cancer. And this corporation was refusing to give her the care that she needed, that she had been paying premiums for. And we had to literally take her pain to their front door to get their attention. Now, we were happy to do that. We want to do that for everybody that joins us at careovercost.org, but we can't do that 248 million times a year. Something's got to change.
Derek Crow, we only have about 30 seconds, but I wanted to ask you quickly, Medicare Advantage, which Brian Thompson ran for United Healthcare, the privatization of Social Security. We're seeing all these ads about open enrollment the past few weeks. What are you urging in terms of the government's use of this privatization of Medicare?
Well, we must stop the government from turning over Medicare to companies like UnitedHealthcare through privatization schemes like Medicare Advantage. And we've also got to get policymakers to take the claims review process, the appeals process, out of the hands of corporations like this and get our healthcare focused on people's needs and not corporate profit.
Well, we'll leave it there for now, but of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. We're going to do a part two with the two of you. We hope you can both stay to talk about where you're directing your efforts now as we move into the Trump administration part two. Derek Crowe with People's Action Institute speaking to us from Washington, D.C., and Wendell Potter, former executive for the health insurance companies Cigna and Humana. He's executive editor of Healthcare Uncovered and author of the books Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans, and also the book Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
The Museum of Lenox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists in the Creation Corner, shopping in the museum gift shop, and a special museum kids holiday shop where kids can shop for $2 gifts and have their presents wrapped. Plus, attendees can also enjoy an immersive seasonal candlelit play, House Guest, created by and starring Kingston-based emerging actors and dance school of drama and music university students. Advance tickets are $10. Details at countymuseum.ca.
I'm stoked. You stoked?
I'm stoked.
Just
I'm
so stoked.
Ready?
Yeah.